Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
Any real estate investment company needs really three things. It needs operational excellence, it needs capital, and it needs deal flow. You got to get the money to buy the deals, you got to have the deal flow to place the money, then you have to have operational excellence to execute your value creation.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, best ever listeners. Welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Ash Patel, and I'm with today's guest, Jacob Vanderslice. Jacob is joining us from Denver, Colorado. He is the principal of Van West Partners. They are a Denver-based real estate investment company specializing in the acquisition, development, and management of self-storage. Jacob's portfolio consists of 3.4 million total square feet of self-storage, including just under 40 properties with roughly 20,000 units. Jacob, thank you for joining us again, and how are you today?
Ash, doing great. Good to see you guys again. Thanks for having us on.
Great to see you. And best ever listeners, if you Google Joe Fairless and Jacob Vanderslice, his episodes will show up. Jacob, a lot's happened since you were here about 3 years ago. Let's dive right into it, man. How are floating rates affecting you? And what's the state of self-storage today?
August of 21, to be exact, was the last time that we did this podcast. And that feels like it might as well have been 1920 relative to how much the world has changed. The floating rate debt issues out there right now are really challenging across all real estate assets, commercial real estate, multifamily, self-storage. And I think the main challenge right now within floating rate debt and the question on floating rate debt is, when was it originated? So if that bridge debt was originated, say, in 2023, that was originated with probably thought and intent, meaning interest rates are probably close to peaking. We're going to go into this deal at a higher interest rate, but we know it's not going to go up much, if at all. We're going to take that risk, and we know we're going to be able to execute our value creation strategy and then refinance when rates moderate back down. So those floating rate loans aren't as challenged. Now, the floating rate loans that are challenged were the ones that originated roughly the last time that we connected, say it was mid-21 or maybe even early 22. And your going in interest rate on one of those floaters might have been, say, 2%. Well, now it's gone up to maybe 8%. And you might have still hit your revenue growth and your occupancy growth targets and your NOI growth targets, but your interest rate has more than tripled in many cases. So what do you do? Well, if your loan's maturing, you have to either refinance or you have to sell. And you go to get term sheets for a refi, and most lenders are not going to give you the proceeds that you need to take out your existing debt because of a coverage issue, given that interest rates went up as much as they did. The other option is to sell. But if you sell, your buyer is going to open up their model and say, I got to buy this thing with this interest rate. I can't pay you that price anymore. So because of all these factors, there is not necessarily macro distress, but there's certainly micro distress. And within that distress concept, there's not necessarily distressed deals. There are distressed capital stacks. The deal might have performed. The fundamentals might have performed. But nobody put into their model that our interest rate's going to go from a 2 to an 8 over a relatively short period. So there's a little bit of blood in the streets. Micro blood, not necessarily macro yet, but we'll see what happens.
Jacob, with commercial real estate, what I do, non-residential, we don't have the option of having floating rates. Most of our loans are locked in for 5 or 10 years. We might have a year of interest only, but those rates are already locked in, as is the principal and interest loan that follows. With multifamily, we know that a lot of the deals were done on interest-only loans for 3 to 5 years. With self-storage, do you know what percentage of loans were done IO versus fixed rate?
Well, when the various loan types, so first of all, just like other commercial real estate, there is no debt out there in the world as attractive as multifamily debt. Multifamily debt is long-term, it's cheap, longer amortization periods, longer maturity dates. In our portfolio and within the self-storage space, kind of depends on the ratio and the deals and when they were acquired. So our Fund 2 portfolio, our Fund 1 portfolio is all 10-year fixed rate debt, but it's also interest only. So you're not amortizing. Our Fund 2 portfolio, we just sold a couple deals in Fund 2. We have one bridge loan left in there, but the other 10 properties are all long-term fixed rate interest only debt. So as far as the capital markets today in the self-storage space, lenders used to give borrowers credit for their future assumptions. So if a borrower is going to buy a value add deal, they would give their lender their model on their NOI growth targets, and the lender might give them loan proceeds that contemplate that growth trajectory and that growth strategy. Now, lenders are looking at that as a data point, but they're not giving you loans based on your future projections. They are only looking in the rearview mirror, and they're sizing loans to something called a debt service coverage ratio, which is simply a ratio of your annual debt service versus your net operating income. And that's how they're going to size your loan. So if you're buying a value add deal, say it's a lease up property, those deals are very difficult to get financed because there's very little trailing data to support that debt service. So the capital markets are not seized up by any means. Debt's still out there, but it's much tougher to get and much lower leverage. The only long-term fixed rate debt you're going to get in the self-storage space is on deals that are either stabilized or getting close to stabilized. The heavy value add stuff, it's all interest only, 2 to 3 year bridge loans. So there's a risk element to that in the form of could interest rates go up? And a month ago, I would say no. And today, as we sit here in mid-April, I'm saying, I don't know. It's possible we could see a hike before the end of the year based on what these inflation numbers do. So capital markets are definitely constrained, and term debt is much harder to source than it used to be.
What are you experiencing in terms of lender appetites for self-storage?
Lender appetites for self-storage are pretty robust still. Just like multifamily, there are some challenged self-storage deals out there. But historically, as we discussed, and I'm sure you know, self-storage has been recession resistant, depending on the cycle type. Typically, when there's a dislocation event, consumer demand hangs in there because people are moving more often and demand increases. Lender appetites have still been pretty strong, but those lender appetites are at the mercy of their balance sheets, their direction from committee, regulatory issues. It sounds like the regulatory environment has been oppressive lately, talking to our numerous bankers, bank examinations, consent orders, all kinds of stuff. The feds are all over banks, and that affects how much they can lend and on what property types. So the appetite's still robust, but within the limitations of what they're allowed to do.
One of my fears for investing in self-storage is most municipalities don't take into account competition. If somebody wants to build a 2x the size self-storage facility directly across the street from you, they typically allow that. So how do you overcome that?
You nailed the risk there perfectly. That is outside of normal real estate risk, like interest rates, cap rates, rents, population density, growth. The main risk in self-storage is the introduction of unforecasted and uncontemplated new supply. Self-storage is very local supply centric. So we'll track supply ratios in the 1, 3, and 5 mile trade radius. And even though we subjectively and objectively defend as much as we can against that risk of new supply, we can't stop a public storage from building a bomber across the street in 3 years. So we'll look at zoning. We'll look at the allowed uses in the submarket, how much zoning is out there, how much land is out there that's zoned for self-storage use. And obviously, it completely varies by municipality, by submarket. We'll look at building permits that are in the pipeline. We'll look at concept reviews in the pipeline. Sometimes if a developer will pre-flight a development project with the city, that might go into their public records and we can pull that up and see this group went in with a concept review. What are the chances that this will get built? Then we'll drive the sites. Are they moving dirt? Is there construction happening? But the trend we're seeing lately, given the difficulty in raising equity and sourcing debt and the fact that construction costs are still very elevated, development and new starts are muted. They're going down. And there are still projects that were baked that are getting delivered pretty soon, but they were baked in a different environment a couple of years ago. But that supply component is definitely a big risk factor. And you'll see when a market's supply shocked, you can see an immediate reduction in rents and occupancies. It's kind of a race to the bottom. So Phoenix right now is a great example of a market that's getting supply shocked. There's a lot of new deliveries coming online. A lot of developers had the same idea at the same time. And it's going to be a while before all of these new units absorb and rents come back. That's certainly a risk factor, and we defend against it as much as we can in our underwriting. But again, you can't stop another developer from building a project some years down the road nearby you.
With the way the markets are today, there's a lot of people pivoting asset classes. Would you recommend self-storage as an asset that people pivot into?
I'm not trying to be elusive here, but it depends on the operator. It depends on the market. Obviously, I'm biased because almost all of our net worth and our business is self-storage. It's really market by market. I'll give you an example here. So going back to the risk profile on supply, we have a number of deals in the Florida Panhandle between Pensacola and Panama City. And in 2021, those were some of our best performing assets. Well, that market saw some new supply come online, and they're still performing, but we're not seeing the revenue growth, and we're not seeing the occupancy growth that we were before just because of that new supply. But those properties are inside of a fund, and you've got market diversification. You've got other deals in other markets that are just crushing it from a lease-up perspective, from a revenue growth perspective. So I do think that self-storage is a defensible asset class, and I think it's a good cornerstone to have within a diversified portfolio. I wouldn't say go all in on self-storage, but find a good operator, find a good sponsor, and I think it's a good asset class to make an allocation to, for sure.
Is there a minimum number of units or dollar amount that Van West will acquire?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the market. So if we identify a fairly small facility, but it's in a submarket that we're already operating within, we can justify buying a smaller deal because we can amortize some of those operating costs across our portfolio within that submarket. If it's a new market and a new deal, generally, we don't like to target anything that's less than probably $4 or $5 million and less than maybe 35,000 net rentable square feet. Once you're going below those two thresholds, as you know, doing a small deal takes as much time and sometimes more time than doing a big deal. It's still the same load on your team. It's still the same overhead. It's still dealing with your banker, raising the capital. So that's generally kind of our threshold on if we see a new deal in a new market that we like, we want it to be sizable enough to kind of justify all the time that'll go into underwriting it, stabilizing it, getting it off the ground.
Yeah, very important what you said. And for the best ever listeners, this might be a hard concept to grasp, but a $5 million deal is much easier to manage than a $500,000 deal often. You just have economies of scale. You don't have to watch every last dime.
Yeah. Let's say you're hiring an on-site manager to manage your store. You're paying your on-site manager maybe 35 grand a year on the 500K deal, and you're also paying them 35 grand a year on the $5 million deal. So your operating expenses as a percentage of your cost basis are materially different, obviously, in those two scenarios. So you need some dollar scale and some square footage scale to sort of amortize those fixed costs across larger dollars and larger square footage.
Jacob, historically, self-storage was fueled by the three Ds: death, divorce, and downsizing. Now, my opinion on this is, let's take death, for example. You know, I'm a Gen Xer, 48 years old. My grandparents were Depression era. So my parents were taught to kind of hoard stuff. And when grandparents passed, the parents would take stuff in. My generation and beyond is not really into hoarding or living large. So when my parents pass, I'm going to go to one of those estate auction places and everything's gone, right? The millennials and the Gen Xers and the Gen Zs, they never upsize. So there's not much for them to downsize into. And when we pass, my kids aren't going to take any of my stuff. So we've got death and downsizing kind of debunked. Divorce. For Gen X and baby boomers, the divorce rate was 53% for first marriages, I think 64% for second marriages. Millennials have a divorce rate of 25%, and they're not getting married till much later. So what's fueling self-storage today?
Yeah, we have a variety of different consumer types. We have small business owners. We have a beverage distributor, for example. They stock all their Diet Cokes and Aquafinas in their storage unit. They bring their truck over. They load and unload. We've got people with lots of toys that don't want to keep it in their house. Maybe it's an ATV or their seasonal gear, golf clubs, skis. These dislocation events, the Ds, those are all a dislocation event, right? It's some sort of life event that causes you to move, upsizing, downsizing your home, new job, marriage, divorce, all the things you called out. Those are the fundamental demand drivers. And it'll be interesting to see as the boomers age and the various generations have kind of different views towards accumulating stuff. It'll be interesting to see how consumer demand changes. We've got some customers who have been with us for 10 years. We haven't owned the deal for that long, but they've been paying $100 a month, 12 months out of the year for 10 years. And you probably could have bought new stuff many times over. So it's a pretty sticky customer base. We did an analysis on one of our portfolios in Fund 3, and that's our offering that's closing fairly soon. We have 11 properties, and longest we've owned the deals in there is 2 years. Some we've owned for 6 months. But the average customer, I should say over 50% of our customers, have been storing in those units for over 3 years. So it's a pretty sticky customer base. But it'll be interesting to see as people age out, generational habits kind of change what consumer demand does. I'm a millennial and I'm guilty of, I got a bunch of family heirloom furniture I don't want in my house, but I don't want to get rid of it. I've got seasonal gear and it takes up a lot of space. And I put it in a storage unit kind of in between houses a while ago. And I was like, I'm going to find the time on the weekend and I'm going to donate this stuff. I'm going to bring some to my sister. I'll get an organizer in the basement storage room and put all my mountain stuff in there. And it's been a year and I still haven't gotten around to it. I'm still paying $300 a month. So that's a common story in this business.
That's very interesting. Last week at the Best Ever Conference, that's what I heard a lot of, is millennials are using storage units as an extension of their living area. So you people, you millennials, you guys never bought these giant mansions like we did. And then we realize it's a really dumb idea. So they are living in much more modest homes. So I've heard that they store winter clothes or Christmas lights and decorations and use it as an extension of their living space. Based on that, are you doing anything different in terms of marketing towards that?
We do a lot of different marketing channels. We do pay-per-click advertising. We pay third parties to market for us. We obviously have our various websites for Clear Home Self-Storage, which is our property management company. But we do target millennials in certain submarkets more aggressively. So for example, we're buying a deal in Jacksonville, Florida in about a month. And Jacksonville, Florida was the number two market in the U.S. behind Tampa for net millennial migration. So a lot of millennials are there. They want to be there. It's a business friendly environment. Obviously the weather's good, job growth, population growth is awesome. So we're much more targeted, will be in that submarket towards millennials than we might be, say, no offense to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right? So it just kind of depends on the market, but we have a variety of different targeting marketing techniques based on our demographic and our consumer type.
Do you track metrics at each of your locations in terms of age and number of visits?
We do. We have so much data on our customers that we're only, by the way, we'll never be good enough, right? We try to get a little less stupid every year. And by the time we retire, hopefully we're less stupid than we were when we started. But we're only beginning to make this data that we have actionable. We've done different studies and analysis on the various demographic types within our units, how customers react to a rate increase, what happens after that rate increase occurs, how old are they, how long have they been there for. And knowing your customer demand helps you really optimize revenue. For example, we figured out that if we do a rate increase on customers, say $10 a month on a given facility, and we see move outs a month later, we assumed that those move outs would probably be because of the rate increase. And our study determined that almost all of those customers were already going to be moving out anyway. They were moving into a new house, or they were leaving the submarket, or no longer needed storage for whatever reason. So that was fascinating. And understanding your consumer behavior really helps you tweak your revenue much more optimally.
What a dilemma. It's almost like the Netflix model, where everyone that has a Netflix subscription, they see the bill on their credit card every month. But when they hear the news story about Netflix raising prices $2 or $3, it's, oh, you know what? I don't really need it. I'm just going to cancel it. Is that the same thing where if you just leave them alone, out of sight, out of mind, they'll keep paying? And now you're giving them a reason to reevaluate?
Yeah, in many cases, this is measured and implemented very carefully. We'll typically do more aggressive rate increases after we buy a new facility and we add amenities to it. We upgraded the security system. We gave you brand new roll-up doors. We seal coated the asphalt. But also on these rate increases, we're looking at the competition. So if this customer is paying $100 a month for a 10x10 and we bring the customer up to $110 a month, what are their options if they still need storage? Well, the nearest facility is 2 miles away. It's busted and tired. Their rates are about the same. Is that customer going to move out with that increase? So it varies. We get some calls occasionally. Hey, why'd you increase my rent? And usually the response is inflation, operating expenses. We add some amenities to it. But by and large, it auto drafts. People notice it. Like I saw a rate increase on my unit, and it wasn't enough to convince me to prioritize the time to get that stuff out of there. And it's an annoyance every month on the first on my Amex. And I look at it for 2 seconds and I think I got to do something about that. And I don't. Another month goes by. So it is out of sight, out of mind to a degree.
Along with the dozen other subscriptions that we all have.
Oh, I can't imagine what recurring charges I have that I don't use on my credit cards. That's another thing that I should get to that I probably won't.
Jacob, do you ever implement some sales psychology where you say we're implementing a $10 per month rate increase, but because you're an existing customer, you only get a $6 increase? Does that work? Because they feel like they're getting something.
Yeah, we'll cut all kinds of deals to retain customers depending on the deal type. We'll give concessions and discounts to new customers when they move in, depending on the occupancy. If somebody is upset about a rate increase and they're threatening to move out, we'll typically work with them and say, for you, my friend, right? One of those things, we'll give you a break for 3 months. So yeah, within reason and within the bounds of managing our revenue effectively, we do cut plenty of deals. On a lease-up project, for example, let's say you do a development project and you open it up and you're at zero. Well, you're not necessarily giving away units, but your rent is really cheap because some revenue is better than none and you want to fill those units up as quickly as you can. So our concessions and discounts and the deals that we'll cut will be based on the deal type, how the deal's performing, supply, right? If we're in a supply shock market, we'll get more aggressive on those concessions and discounts to source new customers. But yeah, we cut plenty of deals for sure.
Good. So there's still a human element to this business.
Yeah, there is. And that's a good segue to this point. Years ago, we experimented with remote management where a cluster of our facilities were not staffed. And other operators have had success with this over the years, but we found that not having someone there cost trouble. We saw increases in theft. We saw a degradation of our customer experience. So all of our facilities are staffed, with the exception of a couple satellite locations that might be a small deal that's a mile away from a big one. So someone will go to the big one, interact with the onsite, get their access information, then drive over to the satellite location. But when you're a customer using self-storage, regardless of your circumstances, you're probably not happy to be there. Even if you're about to move into your brand new house that you just built and you're getting out of the apartment, you're not happy there. You don't want to be at your storage facility. If you go to Starbucks in the morning and you do your mobile order, you walk into Starbucks, it smells good, there's music playing, you're getting your coffee, you want to be there. You're happy to be there, you're getting your day started. You don't want to be at your storage facility. So having on-site managers that are kind, professional, patient, understanding is really important to the customer experience, because a lot of our customers are there for very unfortunate reasons, right? All the D's you mentioned before. Somebody dies or you get divorced, you're probably not in a good mood, and you got to go deal with a storage unit. So having that human element there and having our customers with the ability to interact with a human if they want to, I think is important. And a lot of our customers, like me, don't want to interact with a human. They want to make their rent online, sign their lease online, get their gate code. They skip the leasing office when they show up. There's that optionality there too. But if they want to go in and shoot the breeze with our on-site for 10 minutes about the weather, they can also do that.
We'll get back to the show, but first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
Do you staff these overnight as well?
We don't. Nothing good happens after hours. Nothing good. Occasionally, if a contractor tells us, or someone that's got a business and needing to get to their stuff after hours, we'll allow them access on kind of one-off basis, but if you're open 24 hours, bad things happen at night. Theft, break, you name it.
Interesting. So I assumed that the gate is accessible 24/7, but that's not the case. I like that, because you're right. That's a liability, safety issues, thefts. It's just locked up at night.
It is. In most cases, again, we make some exceptions based on the customer type, but specifically, if we have a building that's interior access, multi-story climate control, if that thing was 24-hour access, real bad stuff could happen, right? It's in an enclosed space. It's conditioned space. We've had people sleeping in units, cooking meth in units, doing all kinds of naughty things. And that's what happens when you have a lot of units. You know, bad stuff happens. But 24-hour access is just not worth the amenity given the risk.
Does Van West also operate those large four-story indoor climate-controlled storage units?
We do. We have a variety of product types. They'll range anywhere from your traditional single-story drive-up non-climate-controlled facilities all the way up to like an urban infill five-story climate-controlled elevator access facility. We have a project right now that we're building in Southeast Denver, and it's going to be about 1,000 units. All in cost basis is about $25 million, and that's five stories, all climate controlled. It's a dense infill site. On these multi-story units, though, you got to be really careful with the market you're operating in, because most customers, if you think about this, if you can avoid it, you don't want to ride an elevator up with your stuff in a cart and then push the cart 100 feet down the hallway, load and unload, and then rinse and repeat. So if you're going to build a multi-story building, you need to be in a location where there's such little supply and so few options that your customers have to ride that elevator up to store. We've seen a lot of deals over the years that have suffered, that were built in more suburban, less dense locations that are multi-story. And you look at the rents on the ground floor and they're X, and you look at the rents on the third story and they're 0.5X, because nobody wants to ride that elevator.
Interesting. And the demographic differences, I'm assuming much more affluent in the four-story units. Are they long-term renters? Do they visit the units more often?
Yeah, generally you see visitation. I keep saying this, I feel like I'm a broken record, but it varies by market. We have some customers who will come in once a week for whatever reason. We can pull their gate access reports and they're in and out all the time. Customer visits don't really necessarily increase or decrease based on the density of the location. We have some fairly suburban locations with like big 10 by 20s and people are in there a lot, just kind of tinkering with their stuff. But inherently, if you've got 1,000 units versus 400 units, you're going to have a lot more customers coming and going. And those 1,000 unit deals on a 5-story building, those units are going to be a lot smaller. So you might catch your seasonal folks, like you mentioned earlier. They've got their Christmas decorations, their mountain bikes, their skis, their golf clubs, their camping gear. They might be coming out a couple times a quarter to do whatever they're doing. But yeah, it varies from site to site.
Jacob, over the last few years, there's been a trend where they build self-storage, but they put a 12-foot bay door in. They make the units either 12 feet wide, 20 feet wide, 20 to 50 feet deep, and they call it flex space. And they charge a lot of money for that. Is Van West getting into that space?
Sort of indirectly and as an afterthought. We've got a couple facilities. One of them's in Northern Colorado, where we've got those large units with big clear height, and they're deep, they're tall, they're wide, and those go for a premium. This was an existing facility, so we didn't build it, but we wish we had more because they command a lot of gross dollar rent. And the customers in those units are very sticky because those are just kind of generally lacking that flex space. But there are operators out there who have built projects with that flex space component as a primary use. We haven't done it yet. We've got a few projects, like I said, that have it, but that's certainly a consideration at some point.
What is one thing that Van West does really well?
Gosh. Well, I would say we get less bad at management every year, property management. And property management's a painful business, as we all know. Dealing with customers, operating expenses, repairs and maintenance, it's a very low margin business. But property management is the key to creating value in any real estate portfolio. And that value creation comes in the form of NOI growth. And NOI is simply gross revenue minus expenses. And that net operating income metric is the driver on value creation in real estate investing. So if you're not efficiently operating your portfolio and you're not controlling expenses and maximizing revenue, you're missing out. And that's why we don't use third parties to manage our deals, because inherently, human nature, a third party does not care about your deal like you do, right? And we learned the hard way. We had the REITs manage our portfolio many years ago. And they certainly know what they're doing, but they're a behemoth and they don't care like an entrepreneur does. Their operating expenses are bloated. They solve to physical occupancy versus solving to revenue. And in our view, our deal suffered. And that's why we started self-managing. So we get less bad at property management every year.
Jacob, on the flip side, what is one thing you wish Van West did better?
One thing that I wish we did better, and there's always room for improvement here, is more detailed analysis of all the deals that we don't buy. So we look at them later and it's a wide funnel. 2022, I think it was 23 actually, looked at 900 deals, we underwrote 250 and we bought 8. And we're working on setting up a system that will track the performance of those 900 deals that we looked at that we didn't buy, whether they traded or they didn't. And we'll look back on these if we kind of remember like, oh, what did that deal do? What happened? We'll pull a title report, see what kind of debt's on it, research the operator. But we're working on getting a more formal system to understand on all the deals we took a pass on, which are almost all of them, what happened and why. And a year or two later, with as much information as we can get, how did that perform relative to what our model said? And why did we not buy it? And then even more so, should we have bought it? Are we really glad we didn't buy it? And I think especially lately, it'd be more of the latter. That's a good thing we didn't buy that deal because, man, it did not take off like the model said it would. But yeah, tracking deals we passed on and just really getting a better understanding of how they performed is something we'll
work on. That is brilliant. I love that because now you could either pat yourself on the back or course correct in the future.
That's right.
How have the rate increases and the softening of the market affected Van West's assets?
So it's an interesting tale. of self-storage rents in the country year over year. You've got two different types of metrics you should look at. One metric is street rates. Street rates are the advertised rates that someone's got on their website. And the second metric, which is much tougher to infer or determine, is achieved rates. So what are these units actually leasing for? So we did a case study. We have a property in Tucson, Arizona. And peak to trough, you've seen a material decrease in street rates from, I think, 2022 to today. They're down by like 40% or some huge margin. Those are the advertised rates. Well, achieved rates are very different. Achieved rates have actually gone up. So what's happening? Well, especially on the REIT side, REITs are offering, and they have been offering for most of 2023, historically different move-in concessions to their customers than they were before. So what the REITs are doing is they'll move a customer in at a rate that's very far below market, and they will more rapidly increase that customer up to market rates. So before, a customer might have seen a rate increase 9 or 12 months into their tenancy at the facility. Well, now that same customer is moving in really cheap, but their rate is going up substantially within 3 or 4 months. So you've got a decline in street rates for a variety of different reasons, but the achieved rates are hanging in there pretty well. There's some markets that have gone way down because of supply shocks. But when you look at the headlines, year over year, street rates have done this percentage decline nationally or in this MSA. Yeah, that happened, but the achieved rates is kind of what you're missing there. So that guy might have moved in at 30 bucks a month. Last year, it was 100 bucks a month. So they went down by $70. Well, that customer's going back up to 100 in 3 months. So it's an interesting tale of data interpolation.
Do your customers sign a year lease or are they all month to month?
Yeah, they're all month to month. And that's one of the interesting things about the business. And one of the benefits and the challenges of the business is all the leases are month to month. So on the revenue management side, you can respond real time to supply and demand changes at the submarket level, the facility level. If you have a unit type that's really full, you can raise rents and probably retain occupancy. If you have a unit type that's lighter on occupancy, you can drop rents below market and kind of fill those up. It's good for the operator because you can tweak your revenue much more real time, and the customer likes it because they're not beholden to a long-term lease and they've got the flexibility to come and go as they please, even though many of them stay longer than they anticipate. The challenge though, in the month-to-month lease, let's say you're going to buy an industrial building and Amazon's got a 10-year triple net lease in the building. Well, you can predict your revenue probably within 0.5% over the next 10 years, assuming they pay, which Amazon will probably pay. You can model it out and be very accurate. This is our NOI. This is their rent. This is our cash flow. It's probably not going to change. Well, in self-storage, we have thousands of units, all of different types in different markets, climate control, non-climate, elevator access, ground level. And you've got market variability. You've got unit type variability, but you've also got seasonality. Certain markets are higher demand in the summer and lower demand in the wintertime. So by virtue of the fact they're all month-to-month leases, forecasting out your cash flows is challenging. Every unit's its own pricing metric, its own pricing algorithm. So basically, if you've got 20,000 units, you've got 20,000 products that you're slinging and that you're pricing. So it's great because it can be dynamic, but it's also challenging from a forecasting perspective.
The grass always appears greener on the other side. For people that are new getting into self-storage, what's often their biggest challenge?
Well, on the greener grass analogy, which we use often, you hear a lot of people talk about no toilets, no tenants, no problems versus multifamily, for example. And that sentiment cannot be further from the truth. We've got trucks backing into gates, causing $5,000 worth of damage. We've got theft issues. We've got customers moving into the wrong units. We've got natural disasters. We've got delinquency. We have to run auctions. So it's a very operationally intensive business. And to a degree, we're almost a retail facing business more so than we are a real estate investment company because we're consumer facing, right? We've got 90 something employees. Most of those are our on-site managers and our regional managers, but self-storage, despite what you might hear, it's operationally intensive for sure. The one benefit we have versus housing, and I'm going to sound like a heartless capitalist here, but you don't have any fair housing laws. So if you're in a state that's not friendly with residential evictions or delinquencies or whatever, self-storage for the time being is not beholden to that. So the eviction process and the remedying of that delinquent customer is a little bit more efficient in storage than it certainly is in multifamily.
Jacob, what is one thing on your to-do list that you've been procrastinating forever? And not personal, business-wise.
Procrastinating business-wise, this is a heavy lift, but we've been in the process of rolling out a pretty detailed monthly report. We've been doing quarterly, but a monthly report for every single one of our funds and syndications. And it's a heavy lift because you got to produce the content, you got to produce the metrics. We've got a number of different syndications. We've got three funds. So it's a lot of emails you got to get right. And we wanted to roll these out first part of this year. We're finally going to do our first one this week or next week and kind of get on this cadence of all these monthly updates. So that's definitely been a procrastination component, because once you do your first one, you set the expectation for that cadence and that increased reporting frequency. You've burned the ships. There's no going back. You got to do it. It's like starting a new podcast, right? You can't do one podcast. You got to commit to doing a bunch of them. So that's one thing we've kind of been procrastinating on, but we've also put a lot of work into it, and the work just took longer, and we're almost ready to roll it out.
What's the typical return for your investors?
When you talk about track record and return targets, I'm going to answer your question in a moment, but as you're evaluating operators out there, whether they're multifamily, self-storage, they've done syndications, they've done funds, track record matters, but it matters less so than it ever has. We've all been American heroes over the last, 7 years. And you could be a terrible operator. You might have executed on your business plan and missed all your metrics. You might have been late, over budget, whatever the case might be. But you were heroic and you were saved by compressing cap rates and rising rents. And that is over. And one thing that people need to understand too is if a sponsor is targeting a 15% IRR and a 2x, you got to remember there's risk to that. And there are assumptions that go into that that hopefully are reasonable and conservative, but a deal never, ever goes like you think it will. It always goes better or worse. It never goes like the model says it will. So two examples to actually answer your question. We did a single asset syndication that just never took off. We didn't see the revenue growth we wanted. We'd underwritten like a 16% IRR, and we're like, let's just get out of this thing. We're not seeing it take off. We sold it last year. It did a 7% IRR. So 16% targeted, we did a 7. We just sold two deals on Friday of this past week in Fund 2, and those deals were underwritten at a 13% IRR, and they did a 33. So the point being is nothing ever goes according to plan, but we generally target mid to high teens IRRs and low 2x over the life of our different vehicles. But again, we're making assumptions on cap rates and rents and values 5 years from now. So we're definitely wrong.
And what's important when deals aren't going right is that you communicate with your investors, and you'll be able to do that with your monthly financials and monthly newsletter.
Yeah, we rolled this out about a year ago, but we have an in-house built custom real-time investor reporting website. You can log in and you can see any one of 25 different KPIs within the portfolio. So if you're a Fund 1 and Fund 3 and a syndication investor, you log in, you see all three of those vehicles. You can see real-time net rental activity, monthly revenue trends. You can graph out different trends over time and see what the portfolio is doing. And accepting capital from an investor is a sacred responsibility that everyone in our space, I think, treats pretty seriously. And having real-time transparency into performance is really important. But this monthly report will kind of augment our Clear Insight software with a quick video message. And here's a couple of metrics on what happened in the portfolio last month.
What's your bottleneck today?
Any real estate investment company needs really three things. It needs operational excellence. It needs capital, and it needs deal flow. You got to get the money to buy the deals, got to have the deal flow to place the money, then you have to have operational excellence to execute your value creation plan. And the operational excellence we'll never get to. We keep getting better and better, but we'll never get to where we want to be. Our biggest bottleneck right now is we sit here and it ebbs and flows by the month, but it's certainly deal flow. Capital raising was really challenging in 2023. We deployed about $55 million in total capitalization across our asset base, which is a decent year, but it was a knife fight to get that equity in. Investor sentiment's pretty negative, but we've seen that kind of pick up the first 4 months of 2024. But as capital raising kind of picks up and people start to digest the newer higher interest rate environment and sort of the touch and go economics, they're getting some more confidence that we've been in this for a bit and there hasn't been a major implosion yet. So they're opening up their checkbooks again, getting back into private real estate. But we need the deal flow to accommodate that. And despite this rising rate environment, it is more competitive for self-storage than it's ever been. There's a lot of new capital out there. People are buying deals at very low return targets, sometimes IRRs that are 6 or 7 over a 10-year hold, which is late. So deal flow is challenging. That's kind of one of our bigger bottlenecks right now. The capital raising is improving. We've got a fair amount of money out there that's interested, but we need the products to place it into. And we're not going to buy a bad deal just to buy a deal.
Jacob, the majority of syndicators that I speak with hyper-focus on one market, and they may expand to a neighboring market. You buy assets all over the country. How do you manage that, and how do you choose the market? Or is it all just on the asset?
I would say to a degree, we're market agnostic. There are certain markets that we don't love that we're not targeting. But where we find opportunity, we'll consider investing there. For example, we have one deal in Columbus, Ohio. It was part of a 2-property portfolio. The deal was all in at about $7 million. We bought it 2 or 3 years ago. It's performing well. We want to get more out there, but the fundamentals of that deal made sense. The submarket made sense. The supply ratios, the revenue growth strategy made sense. So we bought it. We will try to get geographic concentration when we can. We got a bunch of stuff in North Carolina, kind of around the Charlotte MSA. But we'll do one deal in a new market, and we want a story to buy more, but we'll also do 6 or 7 deals in a given submarket. It just kind of depends. But if we focus on one market, let's say we were just focused on Denver. It's our backyard. We live here. We work here. It's where everything happens. We only have 3 deals in the Colorado Front Range. And that's not from a lack of effort. It's just been a lack of the market bearing good deals with risk-adjusted returns that meet our requirements.
Jacob, what is your best real estate investing advice ever?
Take a risk. If you've been reading books and going to the conferences and listening to podcasts and paying for seminars and you haven't done a deal yet, the best way to learn is to do a deal. And that could be deploying your capital into a private placement. It could be buying a single family rental. It could be buying your first small retail commercial building. But everything that we've learned over the years has not been from a book or from a seminar. It's been by making mistakes and learning along the way. So take a risk and do a deal.
You've been very gracious with your time. Let's wrap this up with the best ever lightning round. Jake, what's the best ever book you recently read?
I'm a big reader of historic nonfiction, and I read business books, but I get through them pretty slowly for whatever reason. So this book is called Into the Silence by Wade Davis. It's an account of the first British expeditions to climb Mount Everest back in the 1920s. And it is fascinating. They were fairly celebrated mountaineers that World War I happened. So they all went to war and they saw terrible things. That was one of the worst human tragedies in our history. The amount of destruction and death and miserable conditions. So they went through that. And then they all went off to climb Everest in 1921 and 22. And then again, attempted it in 24. And it was challenging and the climate was hard and oxygen and the weather, but it was relatively benign compared to what they went through in the trenches. And it's a great book. And it just kind of reminds you whatever challenges you might be having here in the richest country in human history at the richest time in human history, you're mad about your Starbucks order getting messed up and you got the wrong coffee. Well, you could be losing your feet to frostbite or getting shot at in the trenches. So it makes it all relative.
Jacob, what's the best ever way you like to give back?
I do a number of things. And the last couple of years, I'm a board member of a local neurorehabilitation hospital called Craig. They do amazing things. If you get a traumatic brain injury or a spinal cord injury, Craig is the place you go to get rehab and learn how to get your life back. Again, if you're having a bad day because of whatever benign issue you're going through, walk through the halls of Craig and look at the guy in the treadmill trying to learn how to walk again. So we spend a lot of time and money supporting Craig. Our business is behind Craig. We're doing a bunch of volunteer events with them this week. But it's called Craig Hospital in Englewood, Colorado.
Jacob, how can the best ever listeners reach out to you and find out more about Van West Partners?
Always love to talk shop about real estate. People can email me, jacob@vanwestpartners.com. Hit me on LinkedIn, Jacob Vanderslice, or go to our website, vanwestpartners.com.
Jacob, thank you so much. We went over on your time. You were very gracious with that. So what a great conversation. Thanks for coming back.
Osh, good to see you guys.
Pleasure. Best ever listeners, thank you for joining us. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review, share this episode with someone you think can benefit from it, Also, follow, subscribe, and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access and you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.